when I was staff at the Channel Star, I was actually the only Black photographer, staff photographer working at a daily newspaper in Canada.
No, it was like, we couldn't go anywhere after that. We would go into, you know, places from Florida and Jackson, Mississippi, and different places, and white people were like, oh, I love you. I love you. Whatever color they were, because they got used to seeing us humanized and not stereotyped.
So it was really good to have a place where you could get, you know, Black stories, the whole gamut, you know.
I'm Julia Fioni.
I'm Simran Singh.
And I'm Manuela Vega. This is Center Scope.
Hey everyone, welcome back. My name is Emma Buchanan. I'm usually the opinion editor here at the Ryersonian, but this week I'll be guest hosting for Center Scope. We'll be hearing from Toronto-based photographers and filmmakers who have paved the way for Black voices in Canadian media and beyond. They made names for themselves both in front of and behind the camera, starting in the 1970s in Toronto. Our first guest, James Russell, is an award-winning Toronto-based photographer turned producer. Tanya Williams is an actor known for her work in The Young and the Restless, who later founded the Real World Film Festival. And Diane Liverpool will speak to us about her work as a reporter for Contrast, one of Toronto's first Black community newspapers. To kick off this episode, we want to take you back to the year 1981 with James Russell at the Miss Black Ontario Beauty Pageant.
So it's a vertical format of Miss Black Ontario sitting in a chair. She was sitting on stage, surrounded by, I believe, several of the other contestants. And she has just this Miss Black Ontario, the winner, just has this, who was Miss, I think she was Miss Rexdale. She has just wonderful smile on her face as she's placing the crown or positioning the crown on her head.
What was it like to be in the convention center that day? Do you remember, like, the energy? The photo looks, like, really joyful. Was it joyful at the event?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There were a lot of excited people. It was an exciting event. I don't know how long the Miss Black Ontario had been going on or how long it continued to go on after that photo, but you know, it was one of the few events that the Black community used to celebrate ourselves, to celebrate beauty, grace, intelligence, and class. The Trinidadians and the Jamaicans and the Nova Scotians all had at one time similar celebrations, but I think Miss Black Ontario was sort of cut across the whole broad spectrum, whether you're a Jamaican or from Nova Scotia or from Trinidad. It was a unifying event, and it was a really wonderful not only to see the women who were contestants, but also to see the audience, because it was an opportunity to dress up, see friends that you hadn't seen perhaps for years, exchange information, and sort of enjoy the culture and the presence that oftentimes Black folks in Canada don't have that opportunity, because we're so spread out.
Do you remember the first time you saw the photo in the darkroom?
Yeah, that's one of the things I loved about film. You stand in this darkened room, and at this time I had It wasn't me developing it. It was one of my friends who worked in the Toronto Star darkroom. And he slides the 8x10 print into the developer, and you see the image come up, and it just blows you away, you know, to see that sort of magically appearing on that sheet of white paper. But I knew that was the photo that I had hoped for.
How do you mean the photo that you had hoped for?
The photo that was going to end up on books and eventually on the in the history books.
Yeah, you were absolutely right. It's the one I've seen so consistently in not only like promotion for the exhibition, but just all over online. I'm wondering, is it the photo that you're most proud of?
No, I don't. It's certainly not any of the photos that, excuse me, that I've won awards for. Most of them were disaster photos or people in tears or in pain. This was one of the feel good photos that I'm most proud of.
Okay, so let's bring it back for a second. How did you start in photography?
I started taking pictures when I was soon after I had joined the Black Youth Organization, which was an organization of kids my age, 20s, 30s, who formed sort of a Black activist organization. We were headquartered on Bathurst Street, just north of Bloor. We had just started a newsletter, and we were all sitting around in this one room, and someone pulled out a Yashica Yashica rangefinder camera, and I think the president of the organization said, "Who would like to volunteer to take pictures?" And the camera kept getting passed around until it finally stopped with me, and I began taking photos for the newsletter.
Must have been fate, hey?
I guess so, if you believe in fate.
So you worked at a local camera shop and then started freelancing for like local papers around Toronto?
I guess back in the early 90s, I started off freelancing for, I believe it was the Tobico Guardian, a weekly newspaper. Then I also began freelancing for the Scarborough Mirror, the Oakville Beaver, and finally I ended up freelancing for the Toronto Sun. And I freelanced for them for about 2 years until they hired a new photo editor who had significant multicultural issues, at which point he advised me that I would no longer be given any more assignments, and I immediately called up the Toronto Star. This was about 1981, and said, "Hey, I'm available." I began freelancing for the Toronto Star. Did it for about 2 years until it reached a point where I was actually making more money as a freelancer from them than I would have as a staff photographer. So they hired me, and I worked at the Toronto Star until 1991. Well, when I was on staff at the Toronto Star, I was actually the only Black staff photographer working at a daily newspaper in Canada. There just weren't a lot of Black photographers. Most of my pushback came from the police, who seemed to be incredulous that there was a Black photographer working at a daily newspaper.
And you mentioned that you had won a lot of awards for disaster photos and stuff like that. I'm wondering what you think between the joyful photos and the more newsy photos, what was the more fulfilling experience for you as a photojournalist?
Yeah, I think I would have to be clinically deranged in order to prefer the disaster photos. Of course, it was the feel-good photos that I enjoyed the most. You know, unfortunately, in the news business, the disaster photos sell better or sell more newspapers. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. When I was working at the Channel Star as a staff photographer, I would sometimes bump into Black photographers, young ones who were doing other things, weddings, portraiture. And in chatting with them, I would always encourage them to sort of consider journalism. Not that, you know, although wedding photography was probably more lucrative, but I was always encouraging young Black photographers to get into journalism because it was important for us to tell stories from our perspective as well. And it was important for us. I mean, I can't tell you the number of photographers I had, white photographers I had to mention that really if you're taking a group of six people, don't put the one Black person on the far end because the light doesn't reach them when you're using your flash. So it was always encouraging. You know, I always try to encourage young Black photographers to get into journalism.
What do you think is missing when newsrooms don't have Black photojournalists? Both, you know, kind of what you mentioned with lighting, but also when it comes to perspectives on where to go and what to cover.
The human perspective. It's important that journalists cover the human side of their readers and Canadians. Too often, newspapers and journalists, because they were assigned a particular story, dealt with the death and unpleasantness in the Black community, and that still happens. Very rarely do you see journalists going into a community, whether it be a Black community or Indigenous community or Chinese community, and taking the time to cover the human side of that community. It's too easy just to report on the shooting at Jane and Finch.
I'm wondering what you think is still missing when journalists, white journalists like me, cover Black History Month.
There's only accurate history. The fact that history is not accurate necessitates, I guess, there being a Black History Month or a Chinese History Month or East Asian History Month. And that's a shame because after all these years, we still can't produce correct history books and accurate teaching of history. We are still producing material that has large gaps. And I find that disappointing.
How can you possibly understand? totally thoughtless, totally careless. You didn't give a damn about me.
That clip you just heard was Tanya Williams, our next guest on the show, who has been carving out space for positive and inclusive representation on screen for over 46 years. She became a household name for playing Dr. Olivia Barber Winters on the American soap opera The Young and the Restless, a role for which she received an award from the Association of Black Women Physicians for increasing the rate of Black women entering the profession by 400%. In 2001, she founded the Real World Film Festival, a film initiative in Canada aimed at drawing attention to the lack of racially diverse and Indigenous talent in media. She's speaking to us from her home in Los Angeles, but today we want to take it back to where it all began, with the teenage Tanya and a milk mustache, right here in Toronto. Tanya, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, like I mentioned, want to take it back to the beginning and beginning of your work in Toronto in the 70s.
Yeah, I remember the first commercial. The first thing I ever did was a Bank of Nova Scotia commercial. I think I was 17. And then it rolled right into that, into a Wear a Mustache milk commercial, which that just is what took everything, like, skyrocketed, because that commercial got so much national play and it ended up with billboards that I was on and just nonstop running commercials for about 3 years of that. So it was that really catapulted me more on the national stage.
What do you remember from being on set for this campaign?
I remember that we were always a collective. There were a lot of other young people. They had posters as well that were shot, and they were in the commercials as well. So I remember I was the only Black person there. So that's usually the distinct story of everything that is in my life. So this was around 1977, and it wasn't just that there were hardly any Black people in front of the camera, but in the crews and behind the crank camera, there were very little as well. So that became a norm. It's never something that makes you 100% comfortable, not because you're the only Black person, but it's a reminder you're the only Black person. It's less about that. It's not a fear thing. It's a constant reminder that you are one of the smaller group of people making it in this industry.
Tanya went on from commercial gigs in her teens to audition for Ryerson's drama program.
Yes, you know, auditioning at Ryerson, when you're looking around and going, it's like they're auditioning like thousands of people and there's only like two Black people here. So these are constant reminders of how little opportunity there were for the people, not only Black, but Indigenous and people of color. It was just a constant reminder. But recently I was speaking at a group and it was primarily white older people. And I said, a question I've always wondered is, white people, as they looked around, did they not think, why is everybody white here? And one guy who was an older white guy said, you know what, Tanya, I never thought about it. So that lack of self-awareness is what we call white privilege. When people go, what is white privilege? You know, they don't really know what it is. It's the fact that you can be in a schoolroom and of 40 students, let's say, and there can be one Black student and 39 white students, and you don't actually even think. It's not that you don't think what's wrong with this picture. It doesn't even occur to you at all to think about it is a privileged white thing.
Mm-hmm. So how did your experience on sets like those in the classroom, like you mentioned, and in the film industry lead you to found the Real World Film Festival in Toronto?
So I started my career, as I told you, I was young. I was like 17 years old, 16, 17. And then I actually did it backwards because I was working in commercials. And then I went to drama school at Ryerson, best years of my life, actually. And then after that, you know, just continued working. This really is to me like a calling, but it's not a calling just for the acting, or I think it's more of a calling of, it's a way one communicates. The entertainment industry to me is a communicative tool. But you need to have something to say. So the roles I chose were because they spoke to something I already wanted to say, and someone else wrote it more beautifully. That's the reason I chose to do some of the work that I did. But I think by the time I'd moved to Los Angeles in 1987, because of the opportunities being so like small in Canada, but I was working in Canada a lot, but it was still not enough. And I think being in Los Angeles, and then I booked the role on Young and the Restless in 1990, it was around the year 2000. I would still come back to Toronto a lot through those years, by the way, to speak at different things. And I noticed that young people weren't just asking me how to get into the entertainment industry or how to create their stories. They were only asking me how they could get to Los Angeles. Everybody in Canada only wanted to know how to get to here. In LA. So that was disturbing to me, because I could understand in 1987, I might've wanted these things. But now, as we approach the year 2000, the opportunities were still not there. So the first thing for us, when I talked to a group of people, which became my first board of directors, was I wanted to create a film festival that was specifically for Canadians who were Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And this was back—
The year after its creation in 2001, Tanya and her team also launched what is now the Real World Screen Institute. It's a place for workshops, mentorship, and now a database for racialized Canadians working in creative or screen-based industries.
Yeah, the people, it's very important to have diversity there. And here's why. You don't, when you're Black or Indigenous or person of color, if the gatekeepers are always white, you know what? You spend 90% of your time not on the project, but explaining the project. Because it's coming from a community, it's coming from an understanding they do not understand.
Mm. That reminds me of your acting in The Young and the Restless. You played Dr. Olivia Barber Winters, a role that was made for you. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Originally, the audition was for the role of Drusilla, so I didn't want to go for it. You know, yet another young Black, you know, this is 19, by then it was 1990. I'm like, I'm over looking at young Black women who are literally living on the street. I'm like, ugh, no. So my agent had said, well, I know it's not a role you're going to want or that you want to do, but I'd really love you to meet the casting director. And so by meeting the casting director, she'll see you and hear you and think of you for something else. So the funny part to me of always with this story is I went in and I read the character exactly how I knew they wouldn't want it. I did not try to, you know, street Black it for them. I read the character like this, and I made a point of reading it just the way I'm talking to you right now, in a way that would never get me that part. So anyway, he said, you have a callback, which made me literally fall off the chair. I'm like, a callback for what? And he's like, for YNR. And I'm like, for Drusilla? Like, how is it I could be getting a callback? It was like the worst audition. They went, no, they have another character called Olivia. I'm like, okay. And then I read the role. I was like, oh, this is fantastic. She's like this professional, she's this doctor, you know, she's dealing with real life issues, and but real life normal issues, I thought, not ones I didn't want to be representing. But it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years later, so I'm doing this role, and I was at a function, I think it was a photo shoot for all the cast, whatever, and Bill Bell was standing there, and we just started to chat about nothing, you know, because he's the big boss, so you find, hi, Bill Bell, how are you today, Mr. Bell, you know, whatever it is. And then we were taught, he goes, you know, I don't know if you ever knew this, but I created the role of Olivia after you had that audition, because you have to understand YNR was coming from a character called Aunt Mamie, a character that had been called Kong. And now they were going to jump to a Black illiterate, you know, street girl, whatever. I think Bill Bell had the sense by the 1990s to understand the audience, everything shifting, there was a change. And he needed to change with that. And we made real impact and changes. And that was brave that they did that. You have to remember, back in 1990, when this happened, they got so much hate mail from the white community, from probably around the world, because the show was around the world, saying, I'm never going to watch a show if you're going to keep Black people on it like this, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it was, but they didn't tell any of that to us. I found that out years and years later. They didn't tell us any of that. We just went along our way doing our show. But then eventually it normalized. And that's why the power of the stories we tell. Eventually white people claimed us like as their family members. You know, it was like, we couldn't go anywhere after that. We would go into, you know, places from Florida and Jackson, Mississippi and different places. And white people were like, oh, I love you. I love you. Whatever color they were, because they got used to seeing us humanized and not stereotyped. And I think that is what makes a huge difference.
If you strolled by the house at 28 Lenox Street in 1979, you might not have known that it was home to a fully functioning newspaper if not for the sign out front that said, "Contrast, eyes, ears, and voice of the Black community." Contrast newspaper was one of the first Black newspapers in Toronto. It was founded by Al Hamilton in 1969. As Canadian novelist Cecil Foster wrote for CBC in 2017, the newspaper was, and I quote, "a magnet for all budding Black journalists, who found the newspaper an oasis in a bleak landscape where Blacks, for the main part, were not seen as reporters, editors, and certainly not as on-air presenters or actors." One of those budding Black journalists was Diane Liverpool, who did her placement at Contrast while studying journalism at Centennial College in 1979. But her journey as a journalist started years before, when she created her own neighborhood newspaper in her hometown of Montreal in the summer of 1966.
When I was 8 years old, I produced a newspaper called McAleer Côte Saint-Luc newspaper. That's where I live, McAleer Street, Côte Saint-Luc was the area. It was a weekly, every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. for 4 weeks, the month of July, 1966. I put out this newspaper. It was 2 or 3 pages. And it was for my neighbors and friends on my street, on McAleer. I wrote the stories on paper, and I wrote stories in pencil. It was photocopied by my father at work. So I'd have these photocopied sheets that walked down the street and gave them to my neighbors on the street.
So what did you personally, what personally drew you to journalism?
I guess my natural curiosity regarding people's behavior and stuff, you know. That's our, I guess, nosiness, I don't know.
Nosiness is, I think, a very valid reason to get into journalism, but I'm biased, obviously. Diane also shared with me that when she was a teenager, the Watergate scandal of the mid-1970s was happening. And that was also part of the reason she caught the journalism bug and ultimately went to Centennial. So you did your college placement at Contrast Newspaper in 1979, from my understanding. For listeners that don't know, could you tell us a little bit more about what Contrast was?
It was a Black community newspaper, and it's a good place for Black journalists and Black photographers to get work, because in those days, the Toronto Star, I know it's hard to believe, now the Toronto Star has a lot of Black columnists and reporters, photographers, and a lot of Black stories, you know, news stories. Back then, the Star and the Sun, only time it covered Black people was like negative news and stuff. So it was really good to have a place where you could get, you know, Black stories, the whole gamut, you know, negative stories about what's happened, you know, police brutality and stuff, and also good stories, achievements, things like that.
How did it feel to be like a budding journalist at that time? Not only seeing those negative portrayals, but I guess finding like, or finding work at Contrast.
It's like home. It was home. It's really good. Because it was a home too. It was a house. A physical house. Like it was a house, but it was an office spaces, but it was a house, right? It was also like, I was there a lot because I was also a receptionist. I was a photographer. Journalist, really. Reporter, that's the word. Reporter, photographer, receptionist, and also I helped with the layout on Tuesday night.
Do you have a favorite photo that you took as a photographer at Contrast?
One of my favorites is actually... one of the teacher and a young student who came from Jamaica and visited Contrast. So it was a picture of the teacher and the students, and they're all sitting around the Contrast sign that says, one that says, "Ears, Eyes, Voice of the Black Community." So they're all sitting around the sign. So that's another one of my favorite pictures.
The caption for Diane's photo reads, "Jamaican teacher and students visit Contrast Newspaper, 1980. In the photo, a group of about 10 kids sit and smile in front of the bold and geometric lettering of Contrast sign, One child in particular beams at you, face squished between their hands, head tilted, basking in the front row. It's the kind of black joy that we still see so rarely in the news, even now that these kids are likely in their 50s. Contrast newspaper closed down in 1991, but Diane and James's photography can be found in the photo collection named after the paper's slogan, Ears, Eyes, Voice, Canadian Black Photojournalists from the 1970s to the 1990s. You can find all the photos we talked about today in the show notes for this episode, along with links to the Real World Film Festival and Institute, and information about James's production company, Manx Studios. I want to thank all our guests this week for their time and their wonderful conversation, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Centerscope is a production of the Ryersonian and the Ryerson School of Journalism. I'm your host, Emma Buchanan. Julia Fioni and Simran Singh are our co-reporters. This episode was mixed by Julia Fioni and Manuela Vega. Manuela Vega is Centerscope's executive producer. Our editor-in-chief is Abhi Rahaja, and our managing editor is Kirti Vyas. Our instructors are Peter Baker-George and H.G. Watson. That's The Scope, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.